Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about design and transport. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We are chatting art, transport, communications history. That's CATCH. I call it the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful, if a little bit geeky subjects, as myself and the fascinating guests. In this edition, one of Britain's best-known and much-loved new breed of telepresenters. He's eternally enthusiastic entertainment expert, and he's the happy, smiling face of London Underground Secrets and Railway Architecture. Welcome to the Catchcast, Tim Dunn.
Mark, thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, it's very good of you to join us today, and we're going to cover your must-view teleprograms and your fascination with model villages. But can we start by taking you back to your upbringing and ask, how did you get so fascinated by our railways?
Well, yeah, I mean, just to stop you just right there, Mark, for going further, because I mean, it's lovely. This is a weekly programme. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm sitting here in my flat near London Bridge Station, and I'm surrounded by lots of railway books and architecture books. The architecture books actually belong to my partner, who is an architectural historian.
Ah.
Yeah, and the architecture books really are his. I've surrounded by the other books, which are railway books, and largely they weren't really mine originally. I think I've probably found a couple of thousands now in lots of bookcases around this flat. But originally, I was brought up with a gift, really, from my grandfather. I was about 3 or 4 when he died. And what left to me, really, were his collection of railway books. So I basically ended up looking at the world and being a very small Timmy through the lens of being brought up on railway books and railway history. They weren't really picture books. He tends to go for more in-depth academic books, I suppose, and some more academic books on railways and geography and the way they've shaped the world. So being very, very small, we were being brought up at school with stories of the ancient civilizations of Rome, of ancient Greece and Egypt. I didn't really care what they did. I was like, well, they're all dead now. It's the railways that formed our world. And so that's really formed a lot of my thinking from being tiny. I mean, tiny. Of living in this world, also living in northwest of London, what we used to call Metroland, famously, from 1915 onwards, creating vast swathes of suburbia and out into the Chiltern Hills, where I grew up, I realised that our world had been largely created by the railway company, even as a small child, and hearing that my grandparents met in the railway station, the Metropolitan, and my parents, you know, growing up in suburbia of northwest London, you know, they only met granny and grandpa, mum and dad only met each other because of the railways. And therefore, I wouldn't exist not for the damn trains.
Didn't I read that your mum and dad met on the Metropolitan, waving at each other?
Yeah, my grandparents.
Oh, your grandparents?
Yeah, yeah. My grandparents did. Yeah, I mean, again, and that is not some sort of narrative that I've woven. It genuinely is true. They met as little school children. They were childhood sweethearts, and they met each other at a compass station, like it might be Kilburn, and they met in different directions. And grandpa got off to Islington to his school, and granny got off somewhere else. And they would meet up again in the afternoons, and they met over the platform. Their story isn't unique, and you look at all those areas, you know, NW6 and W8, all those areas a bit. They are all largely driven by the railway development, as you well know, Mr. Offenden, as you documented many times in your marvellous book. The way that society responded and commerce responded and industry responded to those railway lines breaking out, and the way they sold back those places and developed them and kept them as part of their domain.
We have so much to be grateful to the railways for, but I also want to ask you...
I'm furious about.
Yeah. They've delayed me again. I also want to ask you about another thing that happened to you when you were a kid. Do you remember when you first got taken to a model village?
Let's talk about model villages. We're going to the model. I love this chat. It's great. You're good, Mark. I love model villages because I grew up out near Gerrard's Cross in Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire. A very pleasant upbringing as a kid. You get taken to Beaconscott Model Village, which is ostensibly the world's oldest original designed model village. But let's be clear about this. This is not an estate town like Bourneville or Saltaire, you know, like the great sort of philanthropist built. It is a miniature town where doll's houses, churches, woodland, and crucially, if you're little Timmy, model railways are constructed in a garden. And this chap, Roland Callingham, built this model railway out in the back garden and built this little miniature town and invited people in, and it became very famous very quickly, this little Lilliput, as they called it. And Beaconscott, which is another Beaconsfield and Ascot, where one of his friends lived. This little thing was on newsreels from 1932. It starts to become really, really, really popular on newsreels because it's something interesting, usual for the newsreels and the Evening Standard and the Times. And, you know, you see it in the every single of a graphic. I think it becomes a worldwide sensation, this miniature doll's house world, little people, model trains.
Now, I'm going to ask you more about model villages in a second, Tim, but I'm whizzing through your youth at the moment.
And we're still in the 1920s, Mark.
I know. Haven't even got to the Ebing Dorm.
Oh, well, are you so kind? Yes. So we begin the 1990s. Anyway, so I'm going to talk very briefly. Yeah, so the model village, I ended up working in this model village. It was brilliant. And working there, I was in control of the model railway from the age of 11.
Oh.
And I was paid for it, right? Wow. So it was a 10-scale-mile model railway in the miniature towns and villages, and I got to control them at weekends and then build model buildings that I love.
Oh.
I got paid for it. I mean, yeah, ideal.
Ideal. And this is an amazing grounding you had for many of your also later interests. But what did you actually study at university, Tim?
Well, I studied geography and heritage and historical geography. So I spent most of my time studying the heritage sector, town planning and rural and urban decay in some areas, but town planning. But largely I focused on historical geography, historical mapping, and the heritage industry as a construct, and the way that, you know, we have charted in Britain our own history through our built environment, which always fascinated me from the time I was very small. And my dad, who was a chartered surveyor, I thought, I'm going to learn more about this and learn our towns, cities, and our places around us and why they look like they are today. So it was an incredible grounding in taking forward my interests in history, geography, and planning.
And the university radio station was your first media, I think. Were you bitten by the broadcasting bug by then?
Or? Massively, yeah. I'd end up being the manager of the radio station to go FM, and we won us an award for it at Exeter. And we had loads of fun doing it. But yeah, as we are now, sitting for a microphone, having a chat is lovely because it's nice to talk to one person and the one listener listening right now will appreciate, hopefully, this chat. Good talking to you, my friend. But yeah, I love the audio medium.
Now, you graduated, I think, in the early noughties, wasn't it? And you went into the world of marketing. And I read somewhere that you have a great way of looking at marketing, which you describe as learning how to tell a story.
Yeah, that's right. Which is very much, I suppose, again, with my history background as well. It's about weaving a narrative and explaining something. And marketing is telling a story. Mm. And it's telling a compelling story or an argument. Generally, it is a reason why someone should take a next action. So you market something by creating an action or engagement point of reference that engages somebody. And they think, you know what I'll do? I'll follow this person's recommendation. I will follow that button. I'll follow that trick. I'll do this next thing. I agree with that. We'll disagree with that. I'll do this next thing. Or I'll buy that subject, service, or product eventually of a series of a very long narrative sometimes and what that story is. And I really enjoy, there's so much that you learn when you're learning how to tell a historical narrative and weave a story and look at sources and look at facts and data to then build a new narrative, which is what I think a lot of people in marketing have with 3 degrees or geography degrees. Because again, geography is about telling the story of the place and understanding the place you're in better, which is what I've always sought to do, is helping people understand better the world that we all live in by what has gone before or what exists around us right now. Mm. Your books do the same, do a very similar thing. They explain the maps. They explain the culture and the story behind the things people think they probably know or didn't know they wanted to know about. And suddenly you've given a point of reference and they explain the things around them and the backstory to them using the sources we have available or our best interpretation of that to help people get a start. I know in the books that you write, particularly our design books, particularly on the underground side, is a masterwork in explaining the things we see around us using a very broad selection of interesting sources that you've pulled from different archives to tell something, to help understand London and its transit network.
Mm, and you've used that so well in your telepresenting works, which we are going to cover in a minute. But today we're talking with Britain's bounciest railway reporter. And we are going to ask you all about your TV programmes in a minute. Can I ask you, Tim, how you describe your mission in life?
Oh, my goodness gracious me. Probably to help people interpret the world that we inhabit and show people some of the joy of certain things they didn't know existed. Maybe seeing something, I don't know. That's a very big question mark, Offington. Probably seeing the joy in the everyday or understanding better the things that have shaped us. Which is always usually, let's be honest, goes back to railways. and show people around the railways and talk about opening up the railways for all.
Tim Dunn, you inspire us all. And we've heard about your upbringing surrounded by trains and books and volunteering at Beck and Scott. But what were you doing in the run-up to 2016 that got you picked for BBC4's fantastic Train Spotting Live, Tim?
Oh, well, my goodness. I was working in marketing in a creative agency. And I had various clients. English heritage, and I heard that there was this program being commissioned about train spotting. It sounds like it's going to be a disaster because the narrative was a pretty negative one. And having worked in communications and marketing and so on, heritage, and with the railways, I was very concerned. Like, oh no, this is a negative thing. And the railways have always been very good at marketing their little bit of the railway, but there's been no one looking at the broader cultural impact piece. You know, with British Railways and British Rail. Was very good about doing national marketing campaigns that talked about the impact of railways, you know, and had comms people working on every television opportunity or cinema opportunity on a national level that was quite positive. There was no one kind of representing the railway. So I ended up thinking, myself, I know some good train spotting locations. I've occasionally called myself a train spotter in that I go and look for a particular engine. Sometimes I go and hunt them out on a steam railway or go and look for one that's coming through if it's interesting. But I don't tend to tick things off lists particularly. It's a different form of train spotting. Mm. But a lot of people do that. I thought, you know, there's been so much negativity around train spotting and sort of cruelty of, I thought, unpleasant comedy that was just knocking train spotters, which is ostensibly a lovely, wholesome, interesting hobby by lots of very interested, kind, quite often quiet people who don't have representation. I thought, right. Fine, I'll do this. So I emailed the production company and found myself doing this meeting, so suggesting places to go and do train spotting, which in the end we did film that six on. And in the end, I had this meeting, and as I walked out of the door, I had a shout back from the producer, Tim, do you want to co-present this? I'm okay, all right. So suddenly, 3 weeks later, I was on national television. We had one rehearsal day with me, Peter Snow, and Hannah Fry. Never done live telly before. Oh, well, let's do it anyway. It's fine. Yeah, so that was that. And then that went down really well. And I thought, I like this. Let's go with this. And I thought, again, the railways need a bit of a national love because it wasn't Network Rail's job to do that because they were focused on infrastructure and safety and so on. And I thought, no, everyone's knocking the railway and the national media railway story is always one of strikes, ticket price rises or problems or delays. There was never anything really nice. Michael Portillo's programme was doing a nice thing generally about some cultural places around the railway and what railways could do to town, which was always good, but often wasn't that railway focus. But my dad, having a background in railway buildings, you know, the thing that people love about railways are the buildings, their structures, the iconic things. They didn't go on strike. You know, the prices of tickets are out of trains, not the buildings. And you can always appreciate those. There's a story on the railway. There's a story in every building. Every building has a story to tell. You just need to know how to read that building to learn its story and then tell it again, which is what we do. So I founded a construction company with a friend, and they took this idea of a railway buildings to UK TV, and literally within 2 weeks they went, yeah, we'd like this, actually. And I thought, wow, we could do 3 episodes, maybe. I just sort of drafted out what are railway hotels and stations and big termini, and they're kind of like, yeah, no, we want 10. 10 episodes an hour each. I'm like, okay,
oh,
wow,
goodness.
Okay. And then we did that in the summer before COVID, 2020, wasn't it? And I was also doing other telly as well at the time as a talking head. I also helped with some research various programmes as well. I was writing bits and pieces for various editors and producers for their programmes about railways and trains and engineering. And I thought, okay, this is good. So we ended up doing a shooting around the country, largely a lot of it from people who I knew. If you look at any of the architects of the railways, if you look at any of those programs, the reason that we're all so smiley and chummy on camera to so many people is because I know them anyway. I always thought my job has always been to get the best out of other people. So who do I know who's got access to a great building that they love? Because the key for me is always finding people that love something, because their passion is always great telly, because that's a great story. Find someone that loves the building that they work with and you'll get the best story, because they've done the research and they've learned it. It can be quite easy to fall in love with buildings, places you work and work around or live around. And to find people that spend their lives and dedicate their lives to a building is like listening to a love story. Often they can be quite tear-jerking. And to have the architect of the big station at the top of the Snowdon Mountain, we took him up there for the first time since it opened. And he was crying because it was so beautiful to see people use building he designed, and he was seeing people take joy from the thing that he had created and designed. And that was a beautiful thing to see him cry in happy tears. Wow, that's powerful. And you always ask people, what do you love about this building? What do you love? And they always tell you, oh, I don't know. Sometimes they'll stop and think again, and they go, oh, and they open up and tell you their connection to a building. And that's beautiful.
Certainly was. And I think going back to Trainspotting Live, that was really groundbreaking, you know, by the sound of it, because of your involvement. And it also changed your life. And then you found all these people with architecture the railways built, and you showed us how those buildings impressed them and changed their life. So it's a great, beautiful circle, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also means that those people, a lot of those buildings, you know, hadn't necessarily had a national stage before. And suddenly, I've had people email me, Tim, we've just been to Weems Bay because we saw it on your program. So we took our holiday to take in Weems Bay. Yeah, or Bishopstone Station. We just went there to go have a look at it. That's so good, because it means that it's given the people who love this building a different platform and a different audience. And it's brought those stories into other people's lives for them to then go and interact with them. But last way beyond the telly.
Beautiful.
And way beyond, you know, our stuff. And that's the stuff that you do with your books. You shine a light on a thing that people didn't know about, and they can feel a connection with that. And to see that then develop beyond us and giving as historians, that is a lovely thing to observe.
It is.
People taking their own new routes and being inspired by your own work. It's lovely.
Very nice. Tim, whilst you were still working on Railway Architecture Series, a new opportunity was in development with City Holloway of Hidden London, wasn't it?
Yeah, so we were making Series 1 of the architecture programme. And one of the things that I wanted to go and do was look at some of the underground stations. Mm. And we were looking at different opportunities. And one of them was actually Down Street Station on Piccadilly Line, which is currently being used. It's TfL property. But the London Transport Museum have a programme of events and visits they call Hidden London, which they do to let people have access to these disused railway stations. And so we went down there and had a look at it. And our producer was like, oh, there's lots of these, aren't there? We're like, yeah, that's quite a lot. This isn't the only one. And so he then took forward an idea to then work not just on disused stations, but also try and look at the stories of the London Underground, because it's more than just about ghost stations and hidden London stuff. It's about this, as you well know, and the subway maps and the culture of the undergrounds and its design story is a fascinating. In fact, we had you on the programme, Mark.
You did. Thank you.
We did. No, thank you for coming. And Sid Whittick was my guide around some of these disused stations, with Chris Nix providing some of the academic rigour to some of this stuff, because he was doing a lot of research for us in the background, confirming or denying things that I thought was down there and they weren't or were. But yeah, we had this great time with torches, us showing each other around these underground stations and pointing out stuff we hadn't spotted before or the stories behind certain things. Because the LT Museum has their own narrative they put on these stations, their own story. But you know, that's their narrative. We often wanted to have a slightly different look at this, a broader story, because we had access to other archives and other things. So we often broadened our story out a little bit into more about the city and the area. So we had lots of the interesting detailed stuff, LT Museum. What was enjoyable was in weaving in each episode a narrative between different objects. So going to the Acton Depot, for example, and then finding a particular object that I liked or found that you knew about, that we could then weave in the vehicle and tell that story. And then Chris come and tell us on camera. So it was almost a curation job to some degree. So each episode was actually quite carefully put together. Sometimes we didn't know how those different visits would all fit together till the producers ended up going, how might we fit these things together and stitch them together with a narrative? But we do that in voiceover with images, and but you could generally find everything is connected on the railway and in London. Everything has a connection to something else. Everything is only a couple of degrees of separation apart. The separation you do with archive and content and objects, which is lovely.
It's been a huge success, Secrets of the London Underground. I think it's been the highest rated programme ever on the Yesterday Channel.
Yeah, it was. It has been, yes. And it continues to be quite high rated. I can confirm there are no plans for any more because the company that made both The Underground and also The Architecture Programme, unfortunately, folded, over a year ago now.
Right.
Because it's just the television industry now is different place to how it was 4 years ago. They couldn't really survive. Channels were cutting back their commissions. Sadly, they had to fall apart. So every one of those programmes has now got new jobs in different parts of either the media or in different sectors entirely.
Mm.
So as soon as making it now, she has helped make a programme about railway stations coming out quite soon. But there are no more underground television programmes. They still do thing with their Hidden London Hangout they've got. And I now do TFL's podcast. So we all have our roles in TFL that have come from it. And we're looking at, can we do similar tours to that elsewhere, not just London? So who knows what comes next?
Yeah, everything. You never know where things are going to end up, do you? But we both love The Underground, as we know. But I just wonder, what's your take on its appeal, not just in London, where, of course, it's relevant, but all over the UK and internationally? Why are people fascinated by it, do you think?
Interesting you mentioned, you say its appeal is not just local to London. It is this extremely complicated machine. It's a bit like the railway, part of the railway. I often talk about, one is the fact it's underground, and therefore it's almost this hidden thing that's sort of this trains in tunnels whizzing about the place with an extremely odd heritage of locked up tunnels and doors that are locked. You can't go in, and everyone wants to go through a door that's locked, right? You always want to see what's behind a secret thing. So that's interesting. It's got this massive cultural capital in British culture as well as the underground that powers our capital city. And it is this massive machine of a million moving parts, or several million moving parts every day, including the people that travel on it.
Mm.
I still think that part of its fascination is this fact you have this very dense network of stations, and as a system, it's this big machine that stretches, 20 miles across and 20 miles north-south as well. It is an extraordinarily big self-contained machine, all these trains and things whizzing about the place, in and out of tunnels. It is a machine.
It is. I love that.
And I like people like the idea, I think, of seeing how some parts are detailed and ancient, some are to brand new and sleek and clever. Some bits, like Elizabeth Line, is incredible and cavernous and beautiful. Generally a modern marvel of our times that inspires so many people, the incredible spaceships beneath the capital city you walk into.
I love that. Yeah. I love the idea of it being a machine. And also, I remember when I was doing some of my books as well, and this may well be relevant to The Underground too, people tend to link it to veins and like arteries running in and out of the sort of living city. So it's like a living machine in a way.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, it's taking people in and out. And it, we all know that when it doesn't work, it causes huge blockades of people, and London PLC slows down. And we can't afford London PLC to slow down because if it does slow down, it does affect everyone. Yeah.
Now, on top of all your other work, you're also on the advisory board of both the National Railway Museum and the Railway Heritage Trust, I believe. Tell us about your work with them, Tim.
Oh, two great organisations I love. So NRM in New York and Shildon, County Durham, is now 50 years old this year. Well, it has its roots far, far beyond that. I just serve on that board as an advisor when they need me to drop in and out of projects to help support them on all sorts of interesting things, or to view tip-offs, or to be another pair of eyes and ears around the country, because the collection that they've got, hundreds of thousands of objects, which many are loaned to third parties as locomotives or posters or whatever it might be. And it's also nice to help knit together that heritage sector with people that operate in it. And obviously, I know a lot of people in those sectors. And then I also joined the Railway Heritage Trust on their advisory board. And that's about looking at building on a railway network or for a railway network and spotting things that could have an opportunity and trying to help find business cases or people that want a building to have a new business in it and help marry up business people and people on the railway to the Railway Heritage Trust who will give them a grant. So the chief executive of that, a brilliant chap called Tim Headley-Jones, who used to work on the property for LNER. He basically goes around the country giving checks to people to great community projects, to restore railway stations and bridges and things. It's his job to help people restore these things by giving them great grants.
Wow.
And he's a man who really loves his job. He's the angel coming in with a problem-solving check.
Mm.
But the reason he gives a check isn't because it's just willy-nilly. They do it because the people who come to him and the board, they come say to us, you know, we've got this idea for this building. What can we do with it? Or we want to turn it into a pub or a schoolroom or a shop or whatever it might be, an experience. And if it's viable, we'll, you know, pack in some money towards it and give it a new life, which is all about giving a new life to people building.
Lovely. Lastly, with all this enormous body of work, you've also recently been involved with the Great British Railways Transition Team, I believe.
Yes, I have. So I worked on Railway 200. So I helped shape Railway 200, the start of it, on the steering group with various people in the railway and worked there quite a little for about 9 months at the offices of GBRTT, Transition Team, of to what Railway 200 would look like, which has been this whole last year. And I've worked with various colleagues across the railway industry and railway sector since then, celebrating it. And now we're looking forward, all of us, to what comes next with GBR. Or indeed Great British Railways and perhaps Rocket 200 in 2029. Who knows? You know, who knows? There are many things and there's always a good story to tell on the railway somewhere, someday, because you know the railway is a massive, again, it's another massive machine and there's always a great story to tell somewhere on the railway.
Tim, Dan, you have unstoppable energy, which is just so infectious. It's been a privilege, absolute privilege to chat with such an esteemed railway enthusiast, writer, lecturer, broadcaster. Thank you so much for joining us, Tim.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I have. You can find Tim on social media as at Mr. Tim Dunn and his teleprograms on the catch-up services of u.co.uk. That's just the letter U. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications history. Please do join us then.